Welcome to Permaculture Lifestyle, where we explore the daily pursuits of self-reliance, natural living, and ecological thinking. I'm Sam Sycamore, coming to you from my humble homestead outpost in Simpsonville, Kentucky, on a wet and unseasonably warm day in late January. Today I want to take a hard look at how we view weeds and invasive species, specifically by sharing some experiences I've had as I've gotten to know some of these much maligned plants in my region. I think there's a lot we can learn about critically assessing our culture's relationship with the wild world, and when we do, we come to recognize the limitations of our abilities to control our surroundings, even as we work, and we must, to learn how to be a regenerative asset to the land instead of a liability. Before I dive in, I just want to say thank you so much to everybody who's reached out so far to show support for this show and for the blog as well. I'm really grateful to hear that this message is resonating with the right people. To everybody who's listening, let me know what you think. I would really love to hear your feedback about the show. With that said, I'd like to get started with a quote from Ben Falk from his book, The Resilient Farm and Homestead. He says, quote, "Humanity's prospects for developing a positive presence on Earth depend on inclusion rather than exclusion, synergy rather than simplification. There are no evil plants, just dysfunctional human designs," end quote. When I first started working on a farm last spring, I spent many weeks learning how to identify and destroy all of the various species of weeds that grow throughout our vegetable gardens. Of all the pernicious opportunists I encountered that season, the one that I came to curse the most was known to me only as pigweed. The name pigweed commonly refers to a variety of different herbaceous annuals that tend to sprout prolifically from disturbed soil, like a pasture space recently visited by their namesake. I came to learn that what I knew as pigweed actually referred to several very similar species within the same genus. They pretty much all had bright pink stems at the base and a reddish pink hue under the leaves, and they could all withstand absurd abuse and bounce back 10 times tougher. You could rip them out of the ground and just throw them on the soil, and they would grow new roots as though nothing had ever happened to them. Only some of them, and this is why I cursed them so much, had these incredibly sharp, shall we say, glove-resistant thorns located in all the places where you'd naturally think to grab them when plucking them out of the ground. So one sweaty June afternoon, while weeding in the okra patch, one of my coworkers stopped to ask me about the identity of a seedling she'd just pulled. She asked, "Is this amaranth? It looks just like it. I think this is edible." I said, "No, I don't think so," with what probably sounded like an informed tone. I said something like, "That's actually pigweed. It's a majorly weedy pest around here." By this point, the seasoned foragers are probably getting pretty frustrated because, of course, she was correct. The species that I knew as pigweed were actually from the genus Amaranthus. And not only are they edible, I personally had actually purchased a cultivated variety from a local farmer's market like a few weeks earlier. Meanwhile, we were toiling for hours on end to eradicate these hardy, nutritious herbs from our vegetable fields. Once I really started giving this topic its due diligence, I discovered that nearly all of the plants that I'd been trained to view as the enemy were actually edible, and some were quite preferable to domesticated plants. Not long after the amaranth incident, the wineberries that grow wild along the forest edges of the farm came into season. We spent several days wading through thickets of hairy orange bramble canes, easily exceeding 7 feet tall, and tried our best not to eat more of these tender ruby-red fruits than we harvested to sell. The flavor is absolutely intoxicating, better in every way than any bramble fruit I had ever tasted in my life. Wading through the tangled canes was no easy feat, but I became enraptured by these plants, and pushed on ever deeper even as my clothes were being torn and my hands and face were being scratched up by the hairy thorns. I came to realize that everywhere I stepped and trampled a cane, That break would cause the plant to clone itself, thickening the thicket for next season. What felt intrusive and destructive at first, I understood, was actually precisely what the canes wanted from us. I thought we were extracting fruits from the forest, but really we were obeying the commands of these marvelously cunning plants to propagate them and disperse their seeds as far as we could carry them. It's not exaggerating for me to say that this was one of the few non-psychedelic experiences I've had in my life in which I felt inextricably, if not literally, tangled up in a relationship with some force beyond my grasp, a higher power, if you will. I had never had these better than raspberries before this experience, but they seemed so abundant that I assumed they must be native and well known to people in my region. When I went looking for information about them, what I did find was sparse but disheartening. Wineberries are actually considered a highly invasive and disruptive exotic plant, introduced from China a little over a century ago with the intention of crossbreeding them with North American raspberries to improve the flavor. Well, I would argue that they succeeded in that regard, but in the decades since, wineberries have come to outcompete many of our native brambles and other plants that thrive on the edge of the forest, here in Kentucky and beyond. So, does that mean that I was flirting with the devil out there in the woods? I've been thinking a lot about the encounters I had with weeds and invasive plants last year and how it relates back to my college education. While I was studying ecology in college, I worked in a research lab on campus that primarily focused on the effects of climate disruption on plants, as well as the impact of invasive plant species on forest biodiversity. In other words, two of the most depressing topics in science that you could devote your time to. As would be expected, I quickly developed a healthy hatred for any exotic plant that I got to know. I studied the effects of an invasive evergreen vine called winter creeper on native flora in our city parks. It's not good. I observed the Japanese honeysuckle rapidly taking over the understory and the edges of the local parks. I learned to identify the scourge we call garlic mustard, but I had to wait several years to find out that it's actually delicious. After reading books like Fukuoka's One Straw Revolution and Holmgren's Permaculture Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability, I began to question the merits of the reductionist scientific method that I had taken to be the final word on how to observe the universe. See, I was taught to examine the interactions between organisms by studying them in isolation, usually in a sterilized lab far outside of their natural sphere, and that just never really sat well with me. I mean, what could I, or anyone else for that matter, really conclude about the way the world works from those kinds of observations? This line of thinking forced me to confront some uncomfortable truths about the way that conventional science operates, and the myopia that I think results. I mean, how much faith, because of course it's a matter of faith, how much faith should I have in conclusions drawn from scientific research? How much trust should I place in the hands of amoral reductionists making impossibly minute observations in a vacuum, you know, with a budget and therefore motives, an agenda, an ideology, party lines to toe? Oh, science is starting to sound a lot more like an organized religion or a state government, don't you think? In any case, it's a far cry from the unbiased, objective observation it says it is. Permaculture, I think, is in many ways the antithesis of reductionism, in that it takes for granted that all things are impossibly interconnected, and that we can't even begin to fathom the myriad impacts of removing just one element from any given system. We want to work with systems and all of their splendid complexity and diversity, and accept that we cannot separate the parts from the whole. So what is a weed, and why are we so hell-bent on eliminating them? Reviewing several definitions of the word, I find that each one comes loaded with a whole lot of implicit narcissism and anthropocentrism, which shouldn't be surprising. Wikipedia tells us that, quote, "A weed is a plant considered undesirable in a particular situation, a plant in the wrong place," end quote. The New Oxford American Dictionary defines a weed as, quote, "a wild plant growing where it is not wanted and in competition with cultivated plants," end quote. This was my favorite. The Australian government's website on the environment offers this definition. They say a weed is, quote, "any plant that requires some form of action to reduce its effect on the economy, the environment, human health, and amenity." Undesirable, not wanted, requires action to be eliminated? These are wild plants we're talking about. And baked into the definition is the idea that they are bad and we must kill them. What does that say about how we view the world at large? And then consider those dreaded invasive species. How do you think they were able to invade in the first place? Plants have been manipulating animals into helping them invade new territory for about as long as plants and animals have coexisted on Earth. I'm sorry if this is news to you. I hate to shatter your worldview like this, but those trees don't produce delicious, nutritious, fibrous fruits for you to consume out of the goodness of their photosynthetic hearts. They've got an agenda that supersedes our own, and it's naive to think that we've somehow screwed things up by being really successful at the job that they trained us to perform over hundreds of millions of years. I'm not saying that humans have always introduced the best plants into the most ideal ecosystems. Far from it. But I am saying that this sort of thing has been going on since at least as far back as when we collectively crawled our slimy way out of the ocean. So who are we to apply value judgment to something so far beyond our control? In just about every case, it turns out that those wild, unwanted plants are way tougher than our wimpy, cultivated varieties, and they will absolutely annihilate our sick little vegetable gardens if left unchecked for even a few weeks at the height of the growing season. Wild nature always wins, period. Of course, science is going to keep trying its damnedest to conquer nature, and the results are often kind of pitiful. As a case study, consider the Japanese honeysuckle, Lonicera japonica, an incredibly badass perennial vine that is currently clobbering many native species in our woods here in Kentucky, and well beyond across the continent. Japanese honeysuckle quickly colonizes forest openings and recently disturbed sites by wrapping its numerous shallow roots around nearby trees and bushes, choking them out underground and exploiting their existing infrastructure to propel itself up above the forest floor ahead of any competition. Though it's technically a woody vine, the Japanese honeysuckle grows so large so quickly that it often looks more like a bush or a sprawling tree. A mature Japanese honeysuckle vine will produce approximately 5 to 10 trillion small reddish to black berries, inedible to us. They smell kind of like sour tomatoes to me. Forest managers of the early 20th century, in their infinite wisdom, planted these bad boys all over the United States as a way to manage erosion, they thought. And also because they thought the flowers were pretty, and it seemed as though deer liked having the extra forage available through the winter. Well, our deer certainly do eat the berries copiously, but it turns out they're barely digestible and contain little in the way of nutrition. The Japanese honeysuckle isn't doing the deer any favors. It's exploiting their natural instincts and their abundant, fertilizer, and using them as a vector for conquering our landscape. Instead of helping our dear friends, the deer, make it through the winter, we instead created an unstoppable plague in our forest that's wreaking havoc on biodiversity. And how does science strike back? Well, my wife, Brooke, was once up for a position as a gardener for a local park service, and was dismayed to learn that the job primarily consisted of digging Japanese honeysuckle out of the ground and applying glyphosate, In other words, Monsanto's Roundup across the barren ground. That's pretty much the standard response that forest managers have to offer. If that's honestly the best we've got, then we can safely move on to the acceptance stage of grief and get on with our lives, because what's done here cannot be undone. Arguing with reality is the most surefire way to make yourself miserable. Our puny chemicals are no match for the mighty invasives, so it's about time we relinquish some control and try to embrace what they have to offer. Back in December, after the leaves had fallen from most of the trees in our area, Brooke and I kept noticing this one particular tree growing up along a fence line on our drive home that was just covered with clusters of these brown, golf ball-sized fruits. We pulled off the road one day to check the tree out and quickly identified it as a calorie pear, that is Pyrus calariana, also commonly known by the name of one of its cultivars, the Bradford pear. It is a merciless genetic opportunist and a general blight on the landscape here in the eastern U.S. It was introduced from, you guessed it, China in 1964 as an ornamental by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The trees were prized for their prolific white flowers, but believed to be sterile. It turns out that's only partially true. You see, two calorie pear trees of the same cultivated variety can't pollinate each other, but they can readily cross-pollinate with other cultivars, as well as wild related species. And when this happens, the resulting wild individuals can in turn interbreed, and along the way they often revert back to developing huge woody thorns like their wild ancestors. These unique genetic mutants are now drowning out diverse wooded spaces across the continent with their own wild monoculture. A quick scan of the sparse resources on Google assured me that they are edible, though not especially sweet or flavorful. In fact, they're so little valued that even scavengers like raccoons and possums don't really seem interested in them. So the pears just kind of hang there through the winter months until the frost softens them up a bit and supposedly birds carry them away and disperse the seeds across the landscape. Well, we knew that we could find a use for them. In a few short minutes, we filled our baskets up with nearly 10 pounds of fruit, and we hadn't even made a dent in the tree's full offering. We took them home, washed them off, and stuffed them in plastic bags. I threw the bags on the floor and stomped the pears into a yellow-brown mush. From there, I emptied it into a large, wide-mouthed glass jug, and then I added water and many cups of sugar, plus dry black tea leaves and a couple handfuls of frozen wine berries that I had tucked away back in the summer. After a week or two of vigorously stirring the jar several times a day, my homemade invasive species country wine was ready to be racked to a secondary vessel where it will quietly bubble in the corner of our kitchen for the next several months. By that time, we should be harvesting strawberries and perhaps the earliest of our brambleberries, some of which we will no doubt set aside to ferment for next winter's festivities. Why does it have to be a war? We invited the invaders, and until we figure out and implement better designs and a better understanding of how to work with our ecosystems, this is what they have to offer us. This is the best the land can do with what we've done to it in our ignorance. We should be grateful and humbled by the revelation of the true depth of our naivete. If our fields run rampant with amaranth, then we should be grinding the seeds into a flour and baking bread with the dough to share with our friends. If the cultivated berries sold in supermarkets scarcely resemble the fruits they purport to be, we should revere the wineberry canes for the intoxicating sensory experience that they preserve in non-domesticated places. If the forest gives us tough, bland fruits like calorie pears by the truckload, I say we make gallons of wine and throw a party to celebrate the gift of abundance. That's one way that we can approach this puzzle from a place of inclusion rather than exclusion, and begin to reimagine our relationship with the landscapes that surround us. In the words of Chuang Tzu, we make the path by walking. Let's walk down the path that leads to the forest garden that doesn't require our care, but is improved by our presence. It's not as far away as it looks. Thanks for listening to this episode of Permaculture Lifestyle. This podcast is an extension of the blog, permaculturelifestyle.com, where my wife and I publish our writings about lifestyle design, health and wellness, producing your own food, and learning the skills and traditions of living in tune with the rhythms of the natural world. Check it out. I think you'll dig it. All music you heard today was composed by yours truly under the name Airplane Jumper. And you can find some of that music over at airplanejumper.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed today's show, please do us a favor and rate, review, share and follow on social media, and tell your friends. And please don't hesitate to get in touch with us if you have any questions, comments, or any kind of feedback. Look for the Contact Us link at the bottom of the website. Until next time, this is Sam Sycamore reminding you that a world of abundance is waiting right outside your door. Are you ready to step out?